You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Kaden Tokomingawa. No mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei da. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Da Pare Thursday. My name is Kaden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Pranuja. Efa Akane coming up on the show. For City Councilling this week, I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about Council's transport policy statement and the Waitakere Rangers being left out of the Resource Management Act reforms. I spoke to Associate Professor at Victoria University and Trustee at Better Public Media, Dr. Peter Thompson, about the government announcing that the Broadcasting Standards Authority will be scrapped, and I spoke to Migrant Rights Network President Shir Singh on the government announcing a new test for people applying for New Zealand citizenship. Pranuja, what have you got for us today?
For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert about New Zealand's new trade deal with Singapore, ACT's proposed immigration policy, and the government's leaked emails on Iran. I also spoke with doctoral researcher Claire Reid from the University of Auckland about new findings in her research on how children's screen use affects brain function.
Heaha or whakaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or waiamairane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka wae ware ahiana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakehiri rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o Erirangi Pōho, me Heidi Key, 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309 3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
The government has signed a new agreement on trade and essential supplies with Singapore, aimed at keeping crucial goods like fuel, food, medicine, and construction materials moving during future crises. Meanwhile, ACT has released a new immigration policy, framing it as a way to make immigration work for New Zealand, with proposals including tougher deportation settings and requirements for migrants. And leaked emails around New Zealand's response to US airstrikes on Iran have raised questions about the coalition's foreign policy direction. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke with Shannon Halbert on these topics. A couple weeks ago, we spoke about fuel instability and rising fuel prices in New Zealand. Since then, the government has signed the Agreement on Trade in Essential Supplies with Singapore, which aims to keep goods like fuel, food, medicine, and construction materials moving during crises. How does Labour view this agreement?
Yeah, we're absolutely supportive of it. It's a two-way trade between the nations. It is significant. It brings in about $11 billion annually, and Singapore is the second largest source of investment to Aotearoa New Zealand. It's a nice job, you know, signing off what Labour started. And so we're really glad that the work that we developed, which was a framework for food for fuel, That deal has now been done with Singapore.
What do you think this deal says about how New Zealand is thinking about supply chains and fuel security?
Well, it is limited in that sense. There's nothing there from the government in terms of reducing the cost of living pressure. Prime Minister Luxon committed to fixing the economy and reducing the cost of living. He hasn't been able to do that. And so, you know, in this sense, he'll be crossing his fingers and hoping that this goes a long way.
Prime Minister Christopher Luxon has said the deal is about building resilience in an uncertain world, especially given around a third of New Zealand's fuel is refined in Singapore. What do you think longer-term resilience should look like?
Well, it's important that the relationship is intact, and that's exactly why we, Labour, established the framework in the first place, and Prime Minister Luxon has continued that. It needs to be an ongoing piece of relationship work with Singapore to ensure that it's enduring. But obviously the resilience part is the most important part, but that will take work moving forward.
ACT has released a new immigration policy under the framing of making immigration work for New Zealand. It includes proposals like stronger English requirements, an infrastructure surcharge on temporary work visas, a five-year welfare stand-down for resident class visa holders, and a dedicated overstayer enforcement unit. What is Labor's response to that policy?
Well, I wouldn't trust the ACT Party on immigration. It's the latest example of another coalition party desperately trying to snatch votes from each other, and that's all that this is about.
What do you make of the framing and the language around making immigration work for New Zealand?
Well, the real concern here is that many skilled migrants who come to New Zealand eventually leave to Australia for better opportunity. That's a result of the economic failures of this government, and that's where the ACT Party, the National Party and New Zealand First really need to take a hard look at some of the policies that they are putting up, be focused on making sure that we have the right immigration support and settings in place so that people can contribute to our country in a meaningful way like they want to.
We spoke last week about concern around anti-migrant and anti-Indian sentiment recently. Do you think policies like this risk feeding into that wider discourse?
Well, we've seen that from New Zealand First, and I condemned that last week. And here again, we see another layer of that coming from the ACT Party. What we need to focus on is to ensure that migrants who come here can make long-term contributions to New Zealand, that we don't risk losing those skills heading off to Australia. And we need to play our part as Aotearoa New Zealand to make sure that they can live a good and meaningful life.
ACT has also proposed expanding the role of pharmacists to take on more primary care services, while Labor's proposed the three free GP visits a year. How does Labor compare those two approaches?
Well, Labor supports skilled migrants supporting our workforce shortage areas. And it becomes clear that in the health area, you know, that we do need support, as we currently do, of bringing skilled migrants in to support our health workforce. So in our view, that needs to continue. But I come back to the point I make, which is it's important that we commit to them to make sure that they can build a long and meaningful life here in Aotearoa and contribute in the way that they wish to.
And just speaking on ACT's pharmacy policy, they're framing it as a way to take pressure off GPs and allow pharmacists to handle more common conditions and routine care. Does Labor see this as a useful part of the solution, or does this risk shifting pressure elsewhere in the health system?
Well, we've always had a migrant workforce that has supported in health, and, you know, we hope that that continues. But we've got to make sure that the settings are right, that we're recruiting migrants into the right places, that they have the skills that we need for our critical workforce shortage areas. But what's important here, again, is that we build a meaningful life for them long term, and that immigration isn't set up as a political football in the lead up to this year's election.
I also wanted to ask about the leaked emails around New Zealand's response to the US strikes on Iran. Reporting from RNZ through One News says the email showed Christopher Luxon wanted to move the government towards explicit public support for the US, while Winston Peters pushed for a more neutral position. What is Labor's response to that?
Well, it really shows how Prime Minister Luxon is incredibly out of touch with what New Zealanders think. New Zealanders don't support the war of any kind. But it just demonstrates another layer of a coalition of chaos where the National Party is talking about themselves and they're just not focused on the things that they promised, which was to fix the economy and to provide some form of respite on the cost of living.
Does this raise questions about how foreign policy is being managed within the coalition?
Well, it's clear that the coalition is in chaos. They're taking pot shots at each other and leaking emails that are shown as a covered up as a mistake. Just really shows that they're not on the same page. They don't have the same views. But it does really highlight that particularly the Prime Minister is in a different frame of mind on such an issue. It is concerning, and it's not in touch with where New Zealanders are at.
What does Labour believe New Zealand's position should be when allies are involved in these controversial military actions?
Labour's always stood for independent foreign policy, and we've demonstrated that historically, and we've called for that throughout this process. We don't support this war, and we don't support Prime Minister Luxon's views in particular.
And as we get closer to the election, do you think these foreign policy issues will cut through, or will voters mostly judge the government based on domestic issues like the cost of living and healthcare?
Cost of living is certainly coming up as the number one priority for New Zealanders. It's been clear that the government hasn't been able to fix the economy or provide any respite in the cost of living, and the fuel crisis have made things even worse. So my view is that is the number one priority for New Zealanders. But certainly there is a lot of media, a lot of interest coming up in foreign policy and the global impacts that are being had on New Zealand. And so it wouldn't surprise me too if over the coming months that may raise up in the priority areas for New Zealanders.
That was Shannon Halbert on New Zealand's trade deal with Singapore, ACT's proposed immigration policy, and the government's leaked emails on Iran.
That was our weekly chat with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Council has approved their first ever transport policy statement, which, together with the central government's policy statement on land transport, will shape the future of transport funding in Tāmaki Makaurau, Auckland. Next steps for the policy statement include using it to develop a 30-year regional transport plan. And a petition is being hosted on Our Action Station that calls on the government to strengthen protections for the Waitakere Ranges. This stems from concern that the Waitakere Ranges Heritage Act 2008 has been omitted from the government's replacement legislation for the Resource Management Act. The petition has already reached over 7,000 signatures. For City Counselling, I spoke with Councillor Shane Henderson about both of these topics. I started by asking if he could outline the key points from the Council's new transport policy statement.
Yeah, so we signed off just last week or so the transport policy statement for council. Essentially, it's kind of a roadmap on what council sees as important in policy for transport going forward. So we sort of have a first crack at it as Aucklanders to say, look, we need things like affordable, quick and reliable public transport. We've got to take action on transport emissions, those kinds of things. And then it sort of goes into a separate process where the government also has sort of input because they sort of half fund a lot of the transport system here. And then you essentially get to some sort of happy medium, hopefully. So this is a pretty good start here. It's pretty exciting.
How does this connect to the work central government has already done on transport, including their policy statement on land transport?
Yeah, so we're going to eventually get together around the table with government. So three councillors, three government appointees and a chair. And we're going to hash out a 30-year transport plan. And so what that's going to be is essentially what's important for Auckland over 30 years and the capital projects that we need to be looking to fund. It's exciting because Auckland gets a big say in the room there. And hopefully we can represent the ratepayers' views well at that table, and then we can get together a plan which gives people a lot of certainty in the city, yeah.
Why do you think it's important for council to have their own roadmap for transport spending as opposed to just leaving it up to central government?
Well, I mean, when you look at it practically, Auckland is about a third of the population, maybe a little bit more now, and over a third of our GDP as a country. And so it's crucially important that Auckland succeeds for the entire country to thrive. And so, you know, the flip side to that is that Aucklanders expect to have a really strong say in the democratic process on the future of their own city. And that's sort of why we elect councillors, and that's why we're doing the Auckland transport reform piece, where people have more say over their transport than they did before. And so it's kind of public expectation, I suppose, as well as a practical element. So, yeah, it's important that we we put in writing what's important to the Auckland people around their transport.
And what do you see as the key transport points to highlight during these talks with central government?
Yeah, for me personally, the fuel crisis kind of keeps me up at night, and it's something that I talk about a lot and think about a lot. The answer to me is public transport. So the more people we can get on our buses and our trains, it's a really great system now. And if we can do that cheaply or affordably for people and in a way that works for them, that helps everybody because it helps the tradie that has to drive around and shouldn't have the excess traffic burning excess fuel. It just helps everybody and makes the system work a lot better. So I'll be emphasising public transport initiatives in those discussions, yeah.
And I want to switch now to asking about the Waitakere Rangers. Are you concerned that RMA reforms will weaken protections for the Rangers?
Oh, absolutely. Look, so the government are going through a process of reforming the RMA, so introducing the Natural Environment Bill and the Planning Bill. And there's been no specific mention of the Waitakere Rangers Heritage Area Act, which basically protects the huge forest in the west that we all rely on as a city, as the lungs of the city. That's not specifically mentioned. So I've sort of been following this up and I've been told it's an oversight. But I would really encourage the government to correct that oversight and have specific mention to protecting the Waitakere Rangers. It's so important for the entirety of Auckland, actually the whole of the country, but especially West Aucklanders who are really concerned that they're losing environmental protection.
Do you support the petition on Action Station currently that is calling for the government to strengthen protections for this area?
Yeah, 100%. And it's going around West Auckland and getting thousands of signatures. I think it's really important that we protect the rangers as best we can. I support that petition, absolutely, and I just really applaud the community leaders and the local board and everyone that's been involved in putting that together. I think it's really great. You're really West Auckland heroes, in my opinion.
For people who aren't West Aucklanders or maybe don't know much about the area, why do you see protecting this specific area as so important?
Well, so the Waitakere Rangers area, for those that aren't Westies, it's a large area of forest. It's a huge area of forest, actually, and it's got, you know, you name it in terms of its benefits. It's got walking trails that are amazing. It sort of backs onto some of the best beaches in the city. But from an Auckland perspective, it keeps our air quality fresh, it lowers our climate emissions, all these kind of things. It's environmentally crucial that we protect these huge forested areas because it has downstream effects on the whole city. And, you know, it's something that, as a West Aucklander, it speaks to you, it's part of your identity, and it's just so important that we protect them.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson speaking about Council's transport policy statement and the Waitakere Rangers being left out of the Resource Management Act reforms.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B and text in your thoughts on any of these pieces, 5395.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
Future sounds from the underground. The hottest new tracks from Aotearoa and around the world.
Totally Wired.
Sounds from up to 2 weeks in the future.
Next month, even.
Some of these tracks are like 2027 vibes, bruv.
A great amount of energy.
Totally Wired with Hunter. Tomorrow's music today, 11 a.m. till 2 p.m. Only on 95BFM. Thanks to Flying Out. Flyingout.co.nz.
That's how I learned who my real daddy was. There you go.
Oh, shucks, Merle. You're just something else. Oh, now play My Horse Is Too Slow.
Oh, dang it, Clive. I've been playing for 2 hours now. My fingers are damn well bleeding. There must be a better way for you to hear your favorite tunes.
As trusty as your best pair of spurs, 95BFM's Border Radio is your Sunday evening Americana appointment. Pull up to the campfire every week from 7 till 9 to hear your hosts, Kirsten, Paul and Louie, dishing up a hearty meal of country, folk and blues. Now proudly sponsored by Studio One Vintage Guitars. Check them out at studioone.co.nz.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
New research from the University of Auckland has found children's screen use is linked with later difficulties in skills like attention, planning, self-control, and emotional regulation. The study pulled together 58 studies from around the world, with 81% showing at least one negative association between screen time and executive function over time. Researchers caution this does not prove causation, but say the findings raise important questions on how screen use affects children's development. I spoke with doctoral researcher Claire Reed about what this research found, what executive function actually means, and how parents, schools, and policymakers should think about healthy screen use. To start broadly, what did your study find on children's screen use in later development?
Yes, our study was looking at how there's a lot of research already out there about how screen use is linked to and predicts children's executive function, their attention, their impulse control in particular. And what we want to know is if that happens on a short-term basis, what about over time? And the best way to do it is a systematic review when you look at all the global research and you analyse it and look for patterns. And that's what the study was. We had 4,500 studies that made the sort of short list we had to screen, and we got it down to 58 longitudinal studies that met all the criteria. That was children aged, screen use, they were taken from 2013 onwards when screen use habits changed a lot. They were included just children aged between 0 and 18. And what we found is that these studies were predicting if you had higher screen use at one point in time, later, and that later was generally 1 to 2 years later, up as far as 16 years later, these children had worse, it predicted worse executive function. Your executive function is your brain's management centre, and it's what helps you plan and control and organise yourself to achieve goals. And it's what children need in class, for example. So they need to be able to focus their attention on the teacher to listen to the instructions. Then they need their working memory to remember those instructions. They need their emotional regulation so they don't fly off the handle at other children. And they need to be able to plan and organise themselves to complete their work. So we found that over 80% of our studies found a link between earlier screen use and later poorer executive function. Some of those studies actually found it the reverse way as well. So some of them found a link between poorer executive function. That means they had higher impulsivity or they had worse attention. And then these children with higher impulsivity or worse attention then had much higher screen use or much more problematic screen use at a later date. And that's quite a concerning relationship, because what it implies is that children with higher impulsivity will have more screen use that may then predict worse impulsivity that may then predict more screen use. And it's a really concerning relationship to see.
Your study looked at 58 studies from around the world, and 81% showed at least one negative association between screen use and executive function over time. How significant is that pattern?
It's extremely significant, because these were all different methodologies that were used across all different ages, and they were all finding the same thing. Now, we say 81% found a long-term negative relationship, but in fact 90% found a negative relationship, just some of them only short-term, so at the same time. And there were only a very few studies that measured no relationship. Some of those studies had poor methodology. One, for example, just compared two different groups where they compared a high screen use group against a low screen use group. And the high screen use group, they categorised every child with more than 15 minutes of screen time a day. Now, given in New Zealand, the over 50% of 15-year-olds have more than 40 hours of screen time a week, that isn't a really relevant or accurate measure of screen use. So it was incredibly high, consistent, strong pattern.
What kind of screen use are we looking at? Are we talking about social media, gaming, general device use, anything like that?
Yes, there is a lot of research that is specifically down one area, just down social media, just down gaming. The purpose of the study was to look overall at all the different measures and all the different times. And despite, you know, all these different variables, all these different measures, social across gaming, social media, all of that, video watching, it had the same long-term significant relationship.
Does your research suggest that screen use was directly causing these difficulties or the relationship being more complicated with external factors?
That's a really important point to note. Because the research is longitudinal, that means it's measures taken, we're observing people over time, it's not experimental. And when you're not doing an experiment, you can't control for every other factor. It's not rigorous science to say it caused it. You can't say this caused that. There are other factors involved. So your executive function is shaped by a child's development. It's shaped right through from 0 to 25. And it's things like sleep, it's physical activity, it's your interaction with your peers, it's free play, it's interacting with your parents. That's how your executive function develops. And those factors, obviously, you need to control for when you're looking in this study. So a lot of the studies did control for things like parent socioeconomic status, gender, a whole lot of really important factors, but still you can't say that it causes it.
Your study also mentions neuroimaging studies showing changes over time in brain regions linked to executive function. What stood out to you in those brain images?
I think what really stood out to me is that there were 8 neuroimaging studies, and every single study showed physical changes to children's brains over time. And when you're thinking that there are long-term changes, our brains, like I said, they develop from 0 to 25. They keep growing while you're young till you're about 14, the grey matter. And that your grey matter is your sort of processing computational area. And then it keeps pruning it, which means it's cutting back the things you're not doing, which might be if you're not doing free play or physical activity, cutting back those, social interaction, and focusing on your creating superhighways of the things you do a lot, right through to when you're 25. The kids are really vulnerable at that point of time. And what these brain studies were showing is that children, some of them looked at the actual physical mass of your brain, so how much your brain was growing. And in these ones, children who had higher screen use compared to their peers with lower screen use, their brains were smaller over time. That means the areas to do with your executive function, so again, that's your attention, that's your emotional regulation, that's your working memory, their brains weren't growing as big. Other studies looked at how your brain functions and how the areas talk to one another, because your different areas of the brain have to talk for you to function as a typically human. And what these areas found, the same thing, that these areas had weaker connections where they weren't working well between areas of the brain, again for children with higher screen use. And these studies were scary. They were showing even children as little as 1, there were behavioural and structural changes as far ahead as 6 and 9 years of age for the children who had higher screen use at 1.
Now, how should parents understand this without feeling like they need to panic?
I think the biggest thing for parents to understand is, yes, don't panic, but is that children really need these important developmental experiences for them to thrive. So I try and focus on what my kids, I'm a mum, what they need to help every day to thrive. So obviously, yes, you do need to try and limit your screen time. People are looking for numbers, good numbers to use. The New Zealand Ministry of Health and the World Health Organization both recommend no screen time at all for kids under 2. Your brains are developing so quickly at that point of time, it's just not, no screen time is safe time. And then from 2 to 5, try and limit screen time to less than 1 hour a day, where 1 hour is a maximum, it's not a goal. After 5, the New Zealand Ministry of Health recommend no more than 2 hours of screen time a day. And I then look at what is that screen time displacing? Have my children had social talk and interaction with us? What about with their friends? Have they been outside and played, or have they played in a sport? So I focus on making sure we do the important things first, and then if there's time after doing important things, then we can look at having some screen time.
Now, you've said that action is needed at the policy, school and family level. What would that look like?
Yes, so, and I'll just clarify that the reason I say that is, you know, I have heard people say this isn't, you know, parents are just lazy. Well, I'm a parent. I work really hard at managing it. And it's really difficult for parents to fight against algorithms that were designed to be addictive. And there's actually, so we did a study last year, a separate study sponsored by Smartphone Free Childhood and Freemasons. And it found that 77% of parents wanted an age regulation. And over 50% of parents said that it was too hard to manage the children's screen time. That reflects the US, or global study actually, of over 10,000 parents said it was too hard to manage their children's screen time. And a study as far back as 2020, where over 70% of parents said that parenting was much harder now than 20 years ago. And the three top reasons they listed were all to do with tech. So one was getting devices too early, but they were all children and screen time, social media and tech, and that was over 50% of the cause they felt and why parenting was harder. So parents are clearly telling us they can't do this alone, and children are telling us this too. So in the same research, children were saying that 61% felt it would be easier to give up social media if their friends did as well, but they said it would be hard to give up social media. 66% said it would be hard if their friends stayed on it. As a mum, that's what I'm observing and that's what I'm hearing around me as well. So what mums are telling me, what parents are coming up to me and begging me for, is if we can help change social norms, and this is where the government can come into play, by setting regulations, just like with cigarette smoking or alcohol, we don't say it's socially acceptable for a 12-year-old to be smoking a cigarette. If we're changing social norms, it may not happen instantly, but over time, parents will have that support and have that help to say to their children, actually, this is not a great idea for you to be on social media, and your peers are not on it as well. And classrooms, so again, that's a study that showed that New Zealand 15-year-olds, on average, over 50% of New Zealand 50-year-olds, and this is a study across the OECD, over 50% of New Zealand 15-year-olds are online currently more than 40 hours a week, that over a quarter are online more than 60 hours a week. That's a full-time job, and that's time that's spent displacing other activities. There is very little evidence that using technology and schools helps children learn. In fact, there's actually a lot of evidence showing that learning from paper is actually far better for children's learning than learning from technology. So schools need to play a part of this as well. Another bugbear a lot of parents talk to me about is that they have only given in to give their child to give the child a smartphone because their school requires it for their sports team. So I think schools need to be aware of their impact as well and start changing their behaviours too. Some schools in New Zealand are now getting really good. They've understood this, but we've got a long way to go before it's fair and consistent across the board.
There's been a lot of debate around banning social media for under 16s, and the article notes you've been involved with an advisory panel for a charity that supports New Zealand matching Australia's ban. How does this research inform that debate?
I think it strengthens the debate. Now, they're just specifically looking at social media, and people have chosen social media, or people really care about social media because there are some quite dire outcomes. I mean, when I'm meeting children who are telling me they're seeing 8 hours of self-harm a day, or when I'm meeting paediatricians who are dealing with the suicide attempts, and that's why, I've met with eating disorder specialists who say they're seeing social media is driving pretty much every case they're seeing. It's really clear that's something that needs to be addressed very quickly. What my research is saying is that's not the end, that's the start. We need to think big picture for children, and we need to think about what, you know, in Indonesia, for example, they're actually age-restricting it. It's not a ban. We don't ban cigarettes in New Zealand, we age-restrict them. We don't ban social media, we're age-restricting it, or hoping to. And what they're doing in Indonesia is banning anything that could be harmful to children. That means AI bots. So you ask any 15-year-old boy what ads they're seeing on their Snapchat, every single one I've spoken to, the first thing they'll show me is sexy chatbots, really sexed up chatbots. Also, Roblox. A lot of gaming, well, a lot of the key games that are really popular now are also designed to be addictive. They have things taken from gambling. They have loot boxes. They have rewards, certain intermittent rewards, which is designed. So I've got obviously a degree in psychology. I've done behavioural psychology, and the way to get people hooked into something you know is you use intermittent rewards. There's actually a class at Stanford University where the founders of pretty much every social media company you can think of went to, and a lot of them have taken this course specifically, and it's called Persuasive Tech, and they're using this on our children. So to me, how this research informs it is that if children are spending too long on screens, on a variety of devices, then we need to work harder to help protect them. At the end of the day, parents need help to protect their children. Children need help to be protected in a number of ways. And an age restriction for social media is just the start.
That was doctoral researcher Claire Reed from the University of Auckland on her research on how children's screen use affects brain function.
Well, if you want to save money and health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
The government is introducing a new citizenship test on the responsibilities and privileges of citizenship. Topics will include the Bill of Rights Act, voting rights, and the structure of government. Other proposed questions include human rights, certain offences, and general democratic principles. Currently, applicants only need to sign a form stating they understand these topics. Existing requirements regarding residency, good character, and English skills will remain. The change was announced by Internal Affairs Minister and ACT MP Brooke Van Velden, who says people seeking citizenship should understand New Zealanders believe in certain rights, like freedom of speech, or that no one person or group is above the law. I spoke to Sher Singh, president of the Migrant Rights Network, about this change. I started by asking what his reaction was to the government establishing this new citizenship test.
It's a bit of a shambles, actually, especially with the way things are going on at the moment. For me, the big question is, would this requirement be for everyone? Why I'm saying this is because the example is because of the IELTS level. You know, when transport industry migrants, they have to apply for a residency, they need a score of 6.5, where with the golden visa, they get entry and they get the residency without even sitting a IELTS test. With this new requirement, with the proposal, what I'm thinking of is like when migrants come into the country, they invest, they're living here, they sponsor their parents over, and if if a parent wants to get citizen in New Zealand, it's going to be very hard for them to achieve that score, especially if it's a senior citizen.
And do you think the questions in the test, for example, the government mentioned that they'll ask questions about the Bill of Rights Act, are the most appropriate questions to be asking?
See, I don't think that they're appropriate. If they are going to ask questions, they should base it on something which is achievable. Not everyone will go and learn the Bill of Rights of New Zealand.
But many other countries, including our neighbours in Australia, have citizenship tests. Does it make sense to align ourselves with these countries?
I'm not sure what the requirements in Australia are.
Do you think New Zealand should have stricter requirements at all, or is the current requirements set at an appropriate level?
The current requirements are appropriate. Obviously, if you're going to apply for citizens, you should be able to communicate and in the language and No, a bit of about New Zealand.
And is there anything else you'd want to say about the specific new citizenship test requirement?
Not really. I think, it's going to be quite challenging for, especially my concern is like senior citizens, you know, going back to doing the research and doing the studies again, that's going to be quite challenging for them.
That was Migrant Rights Network President Shir Singh on the government announcing a new test for people applying for New Zealand citizenship.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B. This is B Suite from Japanese Breakfast.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
The Media and Communications Minister, Paul Goldsmith, has announced that the Broadcasting Standards Authority, BSA, will be scrapped with media to self-regulate instead. Goldsmith says this is due to the regulatory framework not keeping up with industry changes, describing the Broadcasting Act as no longer fit for purpose. I spoke to Dr. Peter Thompson, Associate Professor in Media and Communications at Te Herenga Waka Victoria University and Trustee at Better Public Media, about the change. I started by asking if he could explain what the BSA is and the function it serves.
The Broadcasting Standards Authority is a statutory regulator
And that means it has a quasi-judicial powers to oversee broadcasting standards. And those broadcasting standards primarily apply, obviously, to radio and television, and they can also apply to content online that has also been broadcast. Because the Broadcasting Act 1989 is a bit ambiguous about what it means by broadcasting in the digital era, there's, of course, been a huge debate about whether the Broadcasting Standards Authority's jurisdiction extends to other kinds of media service online that have broadcasting-like qualities. And that's one of the issues of debate.
And why has the government decided to scrap it, firstly, but also why do you disagree with their reasoning?
There's a long tale to be told here. Fundamentally, I mean, the government has really enacted a play from the neoliberal book of the 1980s. And I say that because it presumes that deregulation and industry self-regulation can be more efficient and effective and fair in delivering those broadcasting standards, such as accuracy, balance, fairness, controlling discrimination, degradation, privacy, and so forth, than a statutory regulator. And I don't think there's any evidence to say that the New Zealand Media Council, which is the industry counterpart of the BSA that's not statutory, and they oversee mainly news and online media, but they have no powers of enforcement. There's no reason, I think, to suppose that they are necessarily going to uphold these standards better than a statutory regulator. Now, why does the government want to get rid of the BSA? Well, it's an interesting debate because last year, the government put out a series of discussion papers under the set of media reforms that were developed by the Ministry of Culture and Heritage. And they invited public consultation on this. And part of that consultation involved a proposal to modernise media regulation. And that suggested a number of different permutations to reform the BSA, specifically by having industry bodies deal with frontline day-to-day complaints about individual, broadcasting items where, for example, someone had breached privacy or fairness or accuracy standards. But then there would also be a statutory regulator operating in the background that had oversight of those processes and could also deal with systemic or structural issues that were arising in the media ecology. So that was quite important because what the current proposal suggests is that we're going to abandon any statutory body altogether. And that leaves the door open, for a media actor that didn't want to adhere to the standards to do whatever the heck they like. So why would the government decide to go on a different tack, given that these options haven't been publicly discussed? I think it's an ideological response largely, and it's an ideological response to the recent furore over the BSA's decision to officially hear a complaint about comments Sean Plunkett made on his The Platform. And those comments, whether or not they would be upheld or not, aren't really the issue. But the comments that he made seemed to be disparaging to Maori, and that there was a complaint that went through the process. And the BSA said, well, because it's a service that appears to have the characteristics of broadcasting, and it was on a live stream, we're going to treat it as a broadcast, and therefore we think it's within our jurisdiction. Now, my view of that is that the law is perfectly ambiguous on that point. The 1989 Broadcasting Act talks about content, that's delivered through telecommunications. Well, you could say the internet is a form of telecommunication, but it doesn't specifically say the internet or mention online streaming because we really didn't have those back in 1989. And so the BSA has been accused, fairly broadly by the political right of overstepping its jurisdiction, of engaging in a power grab, and some people have even said it's like a Soviet-era Stasi or an Orwellian bureaucracy, none of which are really fair assessments of what the BSA is trying to do. But the political heat over this issue has possibly created an opportunity whereby the current government sees a chance to appeal to a constituency of voters who vehemently oppose any kind of media regulation. And so I think it's political point scoring rather than an evidence-based form of policy development in the public interest.
In simple terms, for a listener who wants to make a complaint, maybe to Sean Plunkett, or maybe they don't like something I've said on air at 95BFM, what exactly is going to replace the BSA?
Well, that's a very good question. I'm not sure if the minister actually knows. In his public statements, he suggested that the New Zealand Media Council would be the model for that. And the New Zealand Media Council has, independent appointees. It usually has a chair that's a retired judge or someone of significant legal standing. And the process would be that, first of all, if you have a complaint about the standards, you would go to the media outlet and see if they would remedy the issue, depending on what the complaint is. And then if you're not satisfied with that, you can direct the complaint to the New Zealand Media Council. And if it falls under the standards which they purport to uphold, then, they can issue a judgment on that. Now, I know journalists who've had complaints about them go to the Media Council, and they generally take it very seriously. I mean, professional journalists don't want to be hauled over the coals and criticised by the Media Council. It's not good for your career and for the media organisation. It's certainly not good for your brand image. Nevertheless, the New Zealand Media Council doesn't have any statutory powers. The Broadcasting Standards Authority does have some limited powers. It can fine you up to $5,000 in serious cases, and in some instances, it can take you off air for 24 hours or suspend your advertising for a similar period. Now, let's say those are relatively modest powers, and they're very rarely used. But the point is that you can speak softly if you have a big stick. And in the digital media environment, where we're talking not just about small local media, but we're talking about global media platforms that have the potential to proliferate all kinds of problematic content online, you might need a very large stick. And countries like the UK and most of the European Union have introduced regulations to address the issue of platform power. And their large stick comes in the form of potential criminal proceedings against managers if they repeatedly breach standards or don't adhere to the regulations. And they also have significant fines of up to 10% of global turnover. Now, all of a sudden, we've got the attention of the big media giants and the platforms. We don't have anything like this here. So the minister's proposal is going in completely the opposite direction to other democracies. It seems to be a blind faith in the efficacy of deregulated markets and industry's willingness to police their own activities. Now, I happen to think that the New Zealand Media Council does a pretty good job. How it could be expanded to cover all media, I don't know. But if you have an entirely voluntary model where you can choose whether or not to be subject to the new regulator's standards, and there are no consequences even if you do sign up for breaching any of those standards, then I worry that this is going to be a real problem that's corrosive to the democratic process. And the reason I would say that is that, of course, our media form the basis of the fourth estate. You know, they're there to provide the public with information. They're there to hold the powerful to account. Well, if those in power or those with powerful interests have control of the media and they decide that they don't want to adhere to those standards, or that in an environment of intense audience fragmentation, competition, loss of advertising to the big platforms, and eroding traditional business models. You know, if you're a media operator in that environment and you're finding that adhering to the standards is now colliding with your commercial interests, and in fact it carries a commercial opportunity cost, to do those double checks, to employ that extra journalist, to make sure that your facts are straight, then first of all there's a risk that you could slowly see a decline of standards, a gradual race to the bottom where standards are a nice to have, not a must do. But the worst case scenario, of course, would be a rogue media operator who was completely uninterested in adhering to any kind of standards or appealing to any kind of public interest principles. I mean, one could hypothetically imagine, for example, an overseas billionaire who had an interest in conspiracy theories, vaccine skepticism or climate change denial, who takes over a significant share of a media company, ousts the board and starts to dictate editorial policy to pump out their own propaganda. Of course, that couldn't possibly happen here in New Zealand.
And unfortunately, we are running out of time in this interview, so I just want to quickly wrap up by asking, what do you see as the immediate next steps for broadcasters now?
Well, some of the broadcasters who have been on the wrong end of BSA decisions are celebrating and crowing about a great victory for free speech. It's not that at all. Poor standards such as accuracy, balance and fairness are not an affront to free speech in a democracy. They're the very foundation of democracy. So I think first of all there's going to be a strong reaction from those groups that recognise that the media have a role to play as our fourth estate and wants to defend those standards and make sure that they're robustly enforced. And for the government, if they actually want to progress their proposal to abolish the BSA, they are going to have to change the Broadcasting Act and a number of other peripheral legislative acts, because you know this is an institution that is actually created by the Broadcasting Act, and therefore you would actually need to rewrite the legislation to abolish it, and that will take considerable time. It would have to go through all the usual legal processes, including public submissions and select committee hearings. So it's by no means a switch that the government can simply flick and have the BSA disappear, much as some of those on the political right might like to see that.
That was Associate Professor at Victoria University and Trustee at Better Public Media, Dr. Peter Thompson, on the government announcing that the Broadcasting Standards Authority will be scrapped.
That was The Wire.
Te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nē te mihi kia koutou katoa I kororo mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for our party Thursday. Nau rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour MP Shannon Halbert, Auckland Councillor Shane Henderson, University of Auckland's Claire Reid, Migrant Rights Network's Shir Singh, and Victoria University and Better Public Media's Dr. Peter Thompson. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1 to 4 with Sophia. Woo!
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.